Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Navajo Talk Radio, brought to you by CalNez Design and Politics on the Navajo Nation. It's purely Navajo. It's Diné, shining the light, blazing the path, standing for you, asking the hard question, bringing facts. It's Navajo Talk Radio. It's Politics on the Navajo Nation and hosted by CalNez.
Hello, everybody. This is CalNez, broadcasting from Mother Earth. And you're listening to Navajo Talk Radio. Today, we have a special guest who's going to call in. And we're going to talk about the hemp industry. You've heard about hemp, right? I think everybody has, and what the possibility of using hemp for economic development on the Navajo Nation. So while we're waiting for our guests to show up, there's a couple of things that I like to talk about. One is that, have you seen that video that was posted and circulating throughout social media that has the school teacher who's dressed up what appears to be like a Native American with a headdress, some psychedelic shirts and pants, and running around hoopering and hollering and pretending to pray to the water gods and supposedly teaching trigonometry and I guess trying to educate the students for to memorize certain formulas within trigonometry. So what do you think about that? It's been amazing. Very amazing that that's still happening in 2021. I posted on my Facebook a little commentary. You know, honestly, when you really think about this thing, you know, here's all the education, all of the things that you can imagine that this society here on Mother Earth, nearly every continent, has become or is aware, you would think that has become aware of all of the different races and cultures that are and how they practice their different spirituality. And here we have, in the United States, in one of the, I mean, it's not an isolated third world country. I mean, we're talking about in California. And I'm sitting here looking at this whole video, thinking that what has all of this cultural and spiritual things or educations, courses, and even on television, how people would handle certain situations. You've got civil rights. I mean, it's literally live. It's all there. And I am just really, really perplexed that those type of images are still happening. You know, I'm really close. I'm located close to that where this incident is taking place. I mean, how clueless, How clueless can this human being be to think that she could dress up like this and run around? I mean, it is just mind-boggling to me how that a school system, or even, I don't know if it's, you know, I mean, I doubt she, this was obviously authorized. She's been, since has been placed on administrative leave, but, you know, obviously having issues with that. So, but here we are, this person running around like that. I don't know if people are, what does that mean to the rest of us now? Does that mean that, I mean, how are we going to approach it? You know, maybe next week is going to be another story, but this week it is a story. And how much longer are we going to, as Native Americans or even as society, how much longer are we going to sit here and tolerate these type of things? When is the dialogue really going on? What is going on? And you think about that. I mean, to me, it's absolute disgrace. I am disgusted that people in America think that they can do whatever they want to do using whatever platform to do these type of rituals. And I think it's very sad. It's not sad. I guess it's infuriating to me. And when I think about how that my posterity, what they face, and even in some of the streets, or like you go downtown in any town and you walk in and you realize that there is a person approaching you, person. I mean, I'll just be as blunt as that. I mean, when they look at my brown skin, what are they looking at? Are they looking at my brown skin, or is it just another person? And what does go through their mind? And if I say I am Native American, what does that say to them? And how, what kind of lens am I being viewed by? Is it something that I'm, well, okay, are they looking at the fact that they've taken my land? Are they looking at the possibility that that it might bring some closure to the situation for what their people have done? What is it? Or do they wish that, you know, okay, they don't, or maybe we don't even exist. Maybe we don't even exist to them. Maybe that's why some of these people do what they do. They go out and they can practice and do and behave the way that they do, putting some fake little paper feathers on their heads and headbands and run around and do these type of things. Maybe it's because they think that we don't exist anymore. Maybe they think that's exactly what their forefathers wanted us to, you know, to do, and that is that we don't have a culture anymore, that we're no longer here in America, that this is all just white man's country, and with a little bit of, black people here, Hispanic there, Asian and Pacific Islanders, except the Native Americans. Maybe we don't exist anymore. But that's a travesty. It's a disgrace in California. It's how the people look at my people, at the Native Americans. I mean, that thing needs to end. It's disgusting. So if you have a comment on that, you're welcome to call in. Also, on the second note is on the Navajo Nation. I was reading the Navajo Times. You know, I was reading about the COVID. Apparently there's been an account set up by the Navajo Nation soliciting funds for COVID-19 help on the Navajo Nation. So they put some figures out there. Apparently $10 million came in, X amount's been used for this and this and this. And there's about $6.6 million left in the account. And there's probably more coming. There's a lot of issues to look at, and one of the issues is that the Navajo people, it's the Navajo people have a need. There is a problem with some of the delivery services. There's still a need. There's still issues out there. I don't know what the health statistics are out there as a state yet, but the thing is that there's been money sent, and that money is was just, I guess, recently discovered that the money has not been used. Now, I'm glad that they found it, but the thing that that really concerns me about the situation every time when it comes to these type of donations or funds that come in federally, or whether in this case it's donation, the Navajo Nation, I don't know what it is and why that it cannot be dispersed the way it was intended to be used. Like, take for instance, one of the biggest things that I found is the Navajo Housing Authority. I'm sorry to bring you guys up, Navajo Housing Authority, but that's an example. You look at their track record, and it's not only just the Navajo Nation, but how many other departments? Well, let me take another department. The Navajo Nation Division of Economic Development, they have a micro-lending program to small business. And they also have a Navajo set aside some sort of a, from the taxes that are in there to be able to use for, to give loans to Navajo owned businesses. So theoretically speaking, if you look at this whole situation, you have a mechanism. That's what one of the things we're going to be talking about tonight is economic development. You have a mechanism right there in Window Rock that has money to lend out. The money is there, like millions of dollars. It's not hundreds of dollars. It's millions of dollars. But we've got businesses out there on the Navajo or potential Navajo business owners who are willing to put up a business on at their various locations, but they cannot access the money. They cannot. And if that holds true for those two departments that I just mentioned and also division, the whole thing also holds true for the for this COVID-19. We keep hearing about this hardship also, and then this money also that is pity. Okay, I'm opening up a whole can of worms here. This ARPA, I think it's called ARPA. Correct me if I'm wrong, but anyway, it's this COVID money, this huge, I think it's $1 billion or something like that. It's a huge sum of money. And that money is supposed to be used for COVID and economic development. There's been several different phases of how that's happened. But the thing is this, is that why are these monies just locked up, so to speak, in each of these departments? And the Navajo people cannot get access to it. Here's one of the things that I always found with the Navajo Nation and its departments. It is, rather than looking at how that they can get the money to the people and its intended purposes, why these monies were earmarked, they concentrate on who they become the greatest gatekeepers in every one of these departments and develop this concept of how not to get the money. What roadblocks and how many questionnaires and qualifications can they put in the way of making or giving somebody the money that they need to start their business, for their health, whatever it is, the COVID money, the ARPA money, every money that you can imagine. Why can't these money be readily available and make the process much easier and have these people who've made themselves the gatekeepers to have the open mind to make it how to make it happen as opposed to how not to make it happen? And these are some of the things that I don't get. I don't understand. To me, I look at it like even a department. Like one time I drove all the way from Window Rock to Shiprock. And I went to the division of one of the tribal offices there just on the east side of Shiprock. I walked in. I had to go to the bathroom really, really bad. It was like about 5 minutes to five. And some guy was walking around, and I went to the bathroom, opened it, it was locked. So I went to the front office, and I said, the bathroom is locked. I really need to go to the bathroom. And they said, well, talk to the guy who's got the key. I can't remember what his title was, but anyway, I found this guy. I said, hey, can I go to the bathroom? He says, no, it's locked. I said, it's not. It's still business hours. I got to go to the bathroom. It's a public facility. But the point was that here's a tribal person who understands that somebody needs to go to the bathroom, or at least should understand, but doesn't understand that somebody needs to go to the bathroom. And just because he has the key, he can say no. And just because that now somebody's asking, he's going to put his foot down and say, here's my entitlement to this. I am a tribal employee and I have the keys and you don't. And that's the same, that philosophy right there is exactly the mentality that we run into in the Navajo Nation tribal offices. Just because they have the key to give you the money, they decide, well, maybe I am the gatekeeper so that you might not do good or you might not better your life than mine. And if I have the key, I can either say no just because I can. And because I can say no, I can take your application and put it somewhere else. That might be hypothetical. It might be way out there just an outlandish sort of an idea, but I wouldn't be surprised because I've seen it happen. And these are some of the things that we must look at. And so as we tonight show, that's what it's all about. What is it? And how is the Navajo Nation going to take some responsibility as a tribe from the gatekeepers to the little man like me who desires to help the Navajo people? How are we going to make this happen? And one of the examples that I always use is that let's take Walmart. Walmart just didn't happen. Walmart just didn't all of a sudden pop up everywhere in the United States and say there's Walmart. No, Walmart was started by one person, one person who had an idea, that he thought he could provide a service and a product to the people. And look at where he's at now. But that one person, somebody, he just maybe didn't have all of the money. He had the money, but he had to subsidize that particular idea to make his business happen. It might have been a bank. It might have been whatever it was, however he encumbered that money. That money, somebody believed in him. Somebody was willing to give him that opportunity. Why not? I always ask this. Why don't we have more Sam Waltons on the Navajo Nation? Why don't we have more entrepreneurs who are given opportunities? Rather than bringing in big box or big chains like McDonald's and churches and Chevron and, you know, you look at all these and bashes, why can't that be, a Navajo last name company rather than bashes? Why can't we do that? Because it's the institution. And that's what we're trying to break, and that's what we talk about. Tonight, there's an industry, and we'll get into this, and this is that the hemp industry, it's been, I heard about hemp from the Navajo Nation government back in 1990. And that 1990, back then, there was a fellow by the name of Irvin Keyswood. He was the Navajo Nation Council delegate. And he was talking about hemp. And he showed me all the paperwork. He showed me all of the things that he wanted to do. It was an innovative thing. Nobody had any idea what was going on, what he was talking about. And he tried to float that idea with the Navajo Nation Council. And as you can tell, it didn't go anywhere. But then you fast forward to last summer and how that the town of Shiprock, New Mexico had an attempt for a hemp industry to develop. And we'll talk about that some more. And so is it going to happen? Are we going to introduce or are we not going to introduce? If we are going to introduce, is it possible for the Navajo Nation government to allow a Navajo private citizen to develop this business? Is it possible? And not only that, is that if you can look at some of the things with our special guest, and I'll talk about this thing, and I'll find out what his ideas are. And one of the biggest questions that I have is that we can have this grandiose idea about how we're going to make this this hemp industry a possible and a viable business on the Navajo Nation. What land base? What land base are we going to use? And the land base, if you look at it, if you totally understand what the Navajo Nation like grazing permits, there's a lot of fight. There's fierce opposition to opening up land by anybody because that's where they graze their sheep and their cattle and their horses. That's how much I have. This is what I'm willing to do. And these jurisdictions, these grazing permits, they overlap each other. And another question that I would have is where the water is going to come from. We have this big pipeline going through the middle or right there in northwestern New Mexico, all the way from San Juan River down to Gallup. And that's another situation that I don't understand. What in the world is going on? Who's going to pay for this and how much, who's going to get what water and this and that? If we're taking water all the way down there, why not develop it and give it to the Navajo people and allow them to develop these businesses. But then again, we have a scenario, and I'll just bring up names. What happened last summer? Dinay Ben Ali. There's one fellow who developed this idea, and he moved forward with it, and we'll talk about all of that, and I've got my ideas and my thoughts and my opinions on that situation. So, but I appreciate it. Let's take a break, and after we come back, we'll bring our guest on. He will introduce himself and where he's from and his plan, and I like the Navajo way. I like it to be very thorough and in-depth. So, Shadana.
Design and politics on the Navajo Nation. It's purely Navajo. It's Dineh shining the light, blazing the path, standing for you, asking the hard question, bringing facts. It's Navajo Talk Radio. It's politics on the Navajo Nation and hosted by Kel Nez.
Oh, yateo, el kunolai, de ti kuro kao nez, enge danza, de kuren de ha e apia, de goi ko in hitchit na hash net do, kuro a hit na de hui net do le aro o khe lan in hitishne. And we have a guest on this evening. Tonight's show is going to be is about, yes. Yes, I can hear you. I'm here with a guest that I met on Facebook, and we talked about the Navajo Nation or the hemp industry. And his name is Mike Diesel, And I like for him to introduce himself, but and we've have had an open we've had discussion on Facebook. But one of the things that I wanted to do is I wanted to bring him on the show and see what his ideas are and if he has some insight on some of the activities that happen in Shiprock. I like to hear about that as well. And as far as how they were going to make this thing happen for the future, so to speak, meaning that can the Navajo Nation develop, can hemp be developed on the Navajo Nation? Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Mike. Why don't you take a few minutes and give us your personal history and all of that plan from where you're at.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Cal, to have this discussion with you. It's something that I believe needs to be talked about because education is the most important thing in getting the information out in many topics. And the misinformation that has been out there that exists about hemp and other plants is what is creating a lot of the flux and the problems, I believe. But first off, my name is Mike Diesel for social media purposes. Real name is Dustin Oliver. I am a Navajo Nation tribal member. My mother was born there at home. She left the res in 1967 and moved to Detroit, Michigan, where I ended up being born, 10 years later. I've been here in Detroit my entire life, fortunately and unfortunately, depending on how you look at that, I guess. Both of my parents worked for the city of Detroit. My father was a police officer who unfortunately passed away when I was 4 years of age. And my mother worked for the city for 34 years. She retired from the 911 department of Detroit. So you could just say that naturally it's in my blood, my DNA to be a helper. And one to help take care of my community and the people around me, especially when there is some type of any type of concern or issue. I've been involved in the cannabis industry basically most of my life. I have been thoroughly involved in our medical marijuana program that we have here in Detroit and Michigan. In Michigan, we have a patient and caregiver system that we have set up, very similar to many other states, where patients can grow their own medicine, up to 12 plants, and then if they are not able to, like many elderly and many people that are actually sick, can't take care of their own plants, then they're allowed to assign a caregiver, which can take care of up to 5 patients and grow the medicine for them. I am a firm believer that cannabis and hemp have thousands of medicinal properties that we have not been able to examine at this point because of the legalities that surround these plants do not then allow for the open research that we need to have. But I would say that I truly believe that Creator left every plant that was left here on planet Earth or Mother Earth for us. It is designed and was designed for us to use cohesively and synchronicity in order to, whether that plant can create a medicine, it can create a structure, a clothing, or a, there's so many other uses that can be used for these plants outside of the ways that they're being used in today's times and in the past. And with that information that is getting, that's coming out, we are learning more and more every day about what these plants can be used for, all the way to the places that they could be used to replace, say, the lithium that we are using for the electric batteries today, which obviously ties to Native American concerns when they are talking about digging up and mining some of our sacred sites. In order to dig this lithium out of the ground, we would be able to simply grow it on top of the ground and then use that and that's replaced for something such as that, that would be detrimental to the earth if they did it in another form. Unfortunately, lots of ways that we've seen throughout time is that greed gets in the way and then leads lots of times what started out to be a good project or something that was walking in a good way. Once greed sets in, lots of times it corrupts humans. And that is a problem using these plants, of course, because there are ways that have been set into place by colonial governments that create a, you know, something all the way to a school-to-prison pipeline. When you make nature, because that's essentially what hemp and cannabis is it's a form of nature, which means it's a form of creator, which means it's a form of us. If we all do come from the same place, from the stars and such, and we are all created of the dust of the earth, then so would that plant. So we should be able to figure out a way where we can work together with Mother Nature to then take care of, house, and feed our own people. So that's a little bit of a small breakdown on some things. There's so much to talk about with these plants, with plant medicine. You know, we could get into all types of different discussions, but mainly this one being around hemp in a specific manner, because again, the information is what has always been hidden from most people, from society. Generally, the wealthy have always hidden the information from the poor people, because if you control the information, then you can control the people. I forget who said it, but if you can control the food and water source, then you will always control the people. And one side of information that people don't know is that hemp, when you use it as a food product, because the hemp seed is one of the most nutritional plants, nutritional food sources, pound for pound, on Mother Earth, and that it holds omega-3, 6, and 9 inside of them at a greater rate than salmon does. That's something simple for that everybody should know about. Everyone should also know that the hemp plant, and when I say this, I'm talking in a textile and fabric side of things. The hemp plant, if you had 1 acre of land, and I heard you talk about where will we grow this, so I'll just throw out a simple place like Nappy, who, if I am to the understanding, has about 110,000 acres of fertile soil there that could be able to grow. 1 acre in 6 months can grow enough fiber for hempcrete to build a traditional 1,000 square foot hogan. You could literally grow your home in 6 months on 1 acre of land. So with Nappy having 100,000 acres, they could essentially grow 100,000 homes in 6 months. That's enough for every single elderly Navajo to have a home. And when we talk about, you know, the different sides of with water and things like that, well, fortunately, hemp, when we talk about it in a textile way and in a fiber way, it uses about 60% less water than a traditional cannabis plant that we would be trying to grow for flower, for instance. So it's really the information that needs to get out there. It's the information that needs to get spread. It's a lot of the resources that we essentially actually have that we could and should be able to utilize, especially for Navajo-owned businesses. As you're talking about, you know, our forms of economic development, this is the currently cannabis and hemp are the number one world job creator. There is no bigger job creator on planet Earth right now than the hemp and cannabis industry. So when we talk about it from a side of employment, then we know that this will create more jobs on the Navajo Nation than any other thing ever has. I mean, we have, unfortunately, you know, I don't know how old the coal mines are there, for instance, but certain assets that the Navajo Nation has are not being utilized in a way where we could actually do economic development for our people in the right way. So there's lots of evidence to go down with these talks. I appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak with you, Kyle. Like you said, we met on social media through Facebook, and you know, I like to speak my mind a lot, and I like to let people know. And sometimes you have to be a little forward in order to get there. And I just appreciate the opportunity to open up this discussion so we can get that information out there for people to hear about it and then be able to ask the questions that they have and then to address the concerns that they might have in talking about these plants.
Yeah. Okay. Well, welcome. I have a few questions here. I think let's start out. Let's go really get into the specifics now. Okay. You've got personally. I'll admit, I have no idea what cannabis is. I have no idea what hemp is. If you can get back and let's say you're trying to educate, well, yeah, you will be educating me. What is it? And how tall are they? And what type of watering does it need? Let's get really into the decision, because then from there, I will then, let's talk about logistics after that. Once we get this plant, identify what it is. What is hemp?
Surely, surely. So hemp and cannabis are essentially the same plant that have similar DNA that fall into two different categories, hemp being the side where you are going to traditionally use it for the textile side of things and clothing. When we talk about cannabis traditionally, cannabis has always been the plant which contains THC-9, which is what society refers to as the part of getting high when you smoke a joint, we'll say, for instance. A joint traditionally would not be rolled out of hemp because you're looking for the cannabinoids. Cannabinoids are a small taste molecular product that's inside of the cannabis plant. So they have those inside of them. So when we're talking the cannabis, lots of times you hear the word skunk always come up because that's one of the flavor and nose smells to it. Hemp traditionally is just going to be the taller, very skinny plants that can grow. There was a new world record actually set just about a month ago, if I'm not mistaken. There was a 24-foot tall cannabis plant. That's extremely high. But traditionally, it is probably about 10 to 14 feet in comparison to cannabis being, and then we would fall into different genres of cannabis because when it comes from different parts of the world, traditionally it's going to have different structures to it. There are the short, bushy ones, which we call the indica side of plants, and those generally come from the Afghan mountain range. So in the mountains, you need to be short and stocky in order to keep your heat inside so you can stay warm for the winter. And then we have the opposite side of the sativa, which is grown closer to the equator, and those tend to be tall and lanky because they need to stay cool, so they have lots of airflow go between. So you essentially have those, and then you have hemp, which we grow for the textiles and clothing side of things. What happened?
Okay, so how do you tell the difference? Is it like, okay, I you brought me in some hemp, and there's a stack of cannabis. I'm able to look at it and say, okay, this is hemp, that's cannabis. The way you're describing it is that they're close in DNA. It looks exactly the same. How do you determine? And can you just go in there, and if they were so distinguishable like that, then what happened in Shiprock? Because Shiprock was being told, the whole city of Shiprock was being told, this is all hemp, and everybody just took Dene Benali's, you know, the word as what it is. Come to find out, it wasn't.
It would depend mainly on at what point of the growth are you talking, can you tell? Because what I will say to this is any plant that grows that comes from seed, for instance, For instance, I have a bag of seed here in my hand, and I could look at this. And if you've never seen even, if, for people that have never seen a tomato seed compared to a green pepper seed compared to a cannabis seed, they might not even know the difference, right? So
right.
When you crack that seed and it starts to germinate, if you, again, if you've never seen a tomato plant, you wouldn't know what I showed you. Now, I don't know how many people in Shiprock have seen all these seeds before or have seen plants when they grow. But when we grow plants, and let's just say the starting process, up until they're 8 inches, for instance, if I had a hemp and a cannabis plant sitting right next to each other that were both 8 inches tall, that the
right.
seeds were cracked on the same day, you would not be able to tell in any way, shape, or form what it was.
Okay, having said that, isn't that the danger in itself right there of what we're dealing with?
No, there's nothing dangerous about cannabis or hemp in any way, shape, or form. Nobody has ever died from either plant, and it is absolutely scientifically impossible to die from plant. Yet we sell Tylenol at the local stores, and people die from that every year. And we have alcohol and tobacco and such I could get into, where 500,000 people die every year from cigarettes, and 0 people die from cannabis. So to use the word dangerous with cannabis, I think is should never be put together. There's no danger in cannabis.
Okay, let me.
So there can't be a danger in that
sense. Yeah, let me reword that. Just in the fact that you cannot tell the difference. In terms of law and regulation, isn't it just the fact that you cannot tell the difference? Isn't that where the inherent confusion might be?
Yes, there definitely could be confusion for sure. And the ways that you could negate down on that and how they have, and they are starting to in the United States, is, of course, starting with regulations. And, of course, right now, through the 2018 Farm Bill that the United States enacted, they made hemp legal in all 50 states. There's not a state in the union, Alaska, Kansas, Missouri, every state can grow hemp legally, all 50 of them. So to me, for instance, to then have a tribal nation, especially when it's my own, to go against the laws that we live under, the entire structure that our nation, our everything is built under, the side of it where I have the problem is the fact that it's the number one job creator in the world right now. So if we're trying to create jobs for our youth, we are doing them a disservice. And I think worse, it's worse than a disservice. I would say that they are cheating us out of our sovereign indigenous rights that even the United Nations gives to us for things such as economic development. And when you're talking about, the confusion in the plants, that is where, I guess some forms of regulations becomes the responsibility of whoever it is that creates the laws inside of their own backyard, for instance. We have that opportunity, so there could be private entities that help regulate how and who gets the certain plants and knowing, because there are tests that you can send out to scientific labs, for instance, that you could test those plants, but on eyesight, you could not be able to tell the difference. Hence, the United States and most states has a lot of, they have a system where they put a little plastic tag on every single individual plant, and there's a barcode on that. And you can scan the barcode, and it identifies that individual plant. And that's how you would take away from that concern, is by implementing some form of tracking system that then would track the individual plants. Because at the end is when you can do the testing on the plants, and then you can say, okay, well, this one is, I'll use some molecules here, CBD, which is probably one that is most referred to when we talk about hemp, and then THC would be the cannabis one. And the way that the law exists inside of the United States right now is that any plant that is over 0.03% THC, then that is not hemp. You cannot have a greater percentage than that and still call it a hemp plant. Some states have higher percentages. I believe it's Virginia that has up to 1%, because they're keeping that THC level down again because the quote-unquote negative connotation that goes with it is you get high on the THC molecule. The CBD molecule has been more related to the healing aspects, where lots of plants are getting turned into salves and such for moisturizers that you can simply, you know, roll onto your aching joints or something such as that.
Right. Well, okay. Having said that also, now you're saying that the obviously there's a lot of potential for this thing, but then again, I'm going back to the basics, and that is that we realize that the Navajo Nation, you said that, well, 50 states has legalized hemp, but the Navajo Nation is a sovereign nation. So the Navajo Nation is essentially doesn't even have to really abide by the rules. It has its own sets of laws. Now, therefore, they have banned cannabis, hemp, everything. It is only in the jurisdiction of the Navajo Nation. So we've talked about this. NAPI is right currently, I don't know how long they've been doing this, but they've got some sort of a study going on over there. And so we can talk all we want to over here and say how beautiful it is, but how do you see getting this to work after what has happened in Shiprock?
You know, that's a good point. What happened in Shiprock, and that falls back to the greed aspect that I mentioned towards the beginning, is extremely unfortunate, and the way that that all went about. How do I see this getting past there? I believe that it starts with education, and it starts with information that gets out to the people so that they don't have a misconception. How do you stop an individual from getting corrupted by greed? I would have to say is you go with you base everything, and this is the way that I lead my life, at least, is I base everything on morals and ethics. And every project, it doesn't matter what I go into, is morally and ethically based. And from my understanding and from my interactions with Mr. Benally, that wasn't his way that he was trying to go about this. When you are trying to get into this business and your goal is to get rich, you are in the wrong business. These plants are here to help build housing, clothing, and food. That is the way that I would go about it when talking to the people, the council, president, the vice president, is that we would be a totally different form, and there are lots of ways to go about it. But when you're looking at it from this standpoint, and how are you going to come into an area where it was already done, quote unquote, in a bad way, you have to come with the opposite side of the pendulum and come in with a good way and a good plan. And I believe that by stating that you're going to grow hemp in order to create affordable, we'll say, because to create anything for free is impossible because you have to pay your workforce, but to create the most affordable and efficient housing combined with then creating a clothing industry that could then get implemented into other forms of fabric for lots of different projects. And then when you add in the food sovereignty side of it, that it adds to the farming aspect, because hemp and cannabis are agricultural plants. This is an agricultural business that we're talking about. And agriculture is commodities. And commodities are assets. And assets are something
agriculture also translates to land base. Where would you grow this at?
You know, like I said, in an ideal world, I would assume that it would be that area that was in the Nappy area. But that's me being not totally understanding of the lay of all of the land on the Navajo Nation because I don't live there. So I don't quite understand the full structure, I will say. But it could definitely be grown in different areas. Now, the thing that gets interesting and kind of comical, unfortunately, about this is the Navajo Nation also has lines on a piece of paper, like the United States does, that separates reservation land from a different piece of property. As soon as you step over that piece of land, I'm on another now possibly public or private piece of property. So if the Navajo Nation continues to not have these things be legal, then entities, and they could be then foreign entities, could come in and just buy land 2 feet away from the Navajo Nation and do this exact project because it would be legal there for them to do it 100% because it's legal in all 50 states. So,
right, but why does it have to be next to
the
Navajo Nation?
Community? I'm sorry, what was that?
But why does it have to be next to the Navajo Nation if anybody can do it?
Oh, I'm not saying it has to at all. I'm just saying that it's, let's say that a local Navajo who lives there now who wanted to do this for economic development, but his nation told him it was illegal, well, then he could go buy land in Gallup. And then he could do it legally in Gallup. And I hear lots of talk from my own cousins at home about how the Navajo Nation doesn't have industries for our youth to work in and get excited about. So they leave the reservation and they go to border towns and they spend all their money in border towns. And I don't have the numbers in front of me to know the economic development that Gallup has taken advantage of from Navajos, or that Phoenix has, or Flagstaff, or Durango. I could go on, of course, but these towns, you could probably say those four towns together over the past 10 years have generated at least $1 billion in revenue. On the very low side, from Navajos. So
right.
We're losing all of that money to these places either way, is the unfortunate side. So,
let's get back. Who would you educate?
The locals of the community where the project would be going into. That would be the first people, because that's, anytime you're going to bring a business concept, a church, a nonprofit, you're going to be dealing with the local community. So I would feel, I mean, obviously you have to talk to the government people that would be in charge, the council, you know, different offices. Economic development needs to be educated. Navajo Nation Council needs to be educated. The elderly need to be educated. The youth need to be educated. The colleges need to be educated. The colleges could be doing R&D projects on things like this. They probably are. I know of one in Colorado that is for sure. But the Dene College could have this as part of their agricultural project because the United States has grants for colleges to do this and for people to go to school for free to do this. I mean, here in my town, we have two universities that have 4-year degrees in cannabis agriculture now. So, you know, by making it illegal, that again is taking away an opportunity for our youth. If, you know, I'll use your word, you know, as we say, the white man's world, if the white man can send their children to college to get degrees and master's degrees and then PhDs in microbiology and plant biology, and then they can get the jobs that our youth are being told that it's illegal. That, for me, is the biggest problem, is that we're allowing everybody else, 573 other tribal nations, to my understanding, we are the only nation that's made hemp illegal. at this point. Correct me if I'm wrong. But that means 573 other tribal nations get a head start before our youth do. And our youth are being lied to by being told it's illegal when all they have to do is step off the land and it's legal everywhere else on Turtle Island. It's legal in all of Canada. It's legal in all of Mexico. It's legal in all 50 states. It's legal on 573 federally recognized tribes, but only one has made it illegal. To me, that is beyond concerning.
Yeah. You had mentioned that there's a huge potential for economic development, and then also I just heard you just say just now in your recent statement, you said if you're in to make money to do this hemp, isn't economic development about making money? So you're kind of saying one thing but saying another.
Oh, absolutely. But I think, and if I misspoke, then if I said make money, I think and I thought I meant to say get rich. If you're in this to get rich, then this is not your. But it is to make money, yes. But for me, when you're working with plants and you're talking about them and you bring in the word money, you have to figure out a way to have them offset each other in a way. And they work closer together. The economic development that can come from this is, for instance, if I'm not mistaken, I heard that the Navajo Nation is going to build, I want to say I heard 12 to 16, I think they called them safety division centers or something of that effect. And if I heard correctly, the initial number that they got, which was more than a year ago, was going to cost $710 million to build these facilities. The new number, if I heard correctly, because of the increase in pricing, was $820 million. I don't know what percentage of that money is going to Navajo-owned development companies, construction companies, drywall, carpet, electrical, plumbing, HVAC. I could go on and on. But the economic development side could be that there could be these private Navajo development companies that then could be growing the hemp to turn into hempcrete. Hempcrete as a building structure by itself is antimicrobial, so it won't grow mold on it. And it's also fire resistant. So, for instance, I'm also in the restaurant world, and when you're building kitchens, you have to build fire resistant walls. And usually they're double-sided, 3/8, I believe it is, drywall on both sides with extra reinforcement. So it costs your sheer development. It costs more to build with those things. When you build with the hempcrete, you save on some of those things. And because of the fire resistant as well, some, not all insurance companies will actually give you more of a discount on your insurance policies as well. But making money is a long-term thing for businesses over the long term instead of looking at it from a short term. So if I did misspeak, I'm saying if you're getting into this to get rich and definitely in a short term, that's not the way to go about this. This is for the long game because for the next 20 to 30 years, this will be the number one job creator. So this isn't a short 3, 5, 10-year business plan. This is a generational business plan that goes on and then helps to create generational wealth, which then can be handed down to our youth that will come behind us.
What about the, you're talking about, let's take the hempcrete. You've got a whole bunch of plants. Volume-wise, how big of a volume would you need to harvest? And what are the other byproducts of this? And how big a facility? What type of machinery do you need to make hempcrete?
So my numbers won't be exact here. But hempcrete on the general, I would say, from my understanding, I know that 1 acre, and we can use that because then you can scale it, of course, in size. So 1 acre is enough to grow the 1,000-square-foot home model. And on that 1 acre, you would have between or about 8,000 plants. And that's because they don't need the spacing that the cannabis plants. They grow more like corn as far as how close they grow together. You just want the stalks from the plant. That's all you're looking for. You're not trying to grow it to be pretty. You're not growing it to be beautiful. You know, you're not worried about those sides of ingestion. So you're just growing it for that. So that's the space and the plant count size. You know, the beautiful thing about the Navajo Nation is the area that we're in and how much sunlight we get and things of that nature. So these plants are made to be grown outdoors. The facility size that you're speaking of, it would depend on, well, we're talking for hempcrete, of course. So it would depend on, I guess, how many homes you're going to get into wanting to build, because it would be a scalability size thing, of course. But there's only 4 to 5 products that go into hempcrete, and that's essentially water, the hull, which is the breakdown of the plant, use lime as a bonding agent, and forgetting the other. There, I mean, you can do a couple of extra things that some would say makes it a little more rigid or weight-bearing, and there's a couple of things you can play with in that way. Hemp naturally, on another side of the beautiful thing about it is it cleans up the land that it's growing on. It actually helps to clean the soil. So one of the great things and one of the many problems that we have in the Navajo Nation is, of course, the uranium mines that are abandoned. And you can grow hemp around a area that is essentially not clean. This is what they did in Russia with Chernobyl. They grew hemp, millions and millions and millions and millions of plants around Chernobyl to help clean up the land there. It is the number one, that's essentially one of the number one things that hemp actually does, is help clean up the land naturally. And it helps to put nutrients back into the soil. So, I mean, essentially you could have, let's say, a facility that was the size of that same acre, you know, built out, I don't know, call it a 50,000 square foot place, so you could have plenty of employees. And it would just depend on the scale and the size of growth that you're trying to do for the individual business. The Navajo Nation has so much land, and so much land that stays warm and gets sunlight throughout the year, that a place like, you know, I won't use any individual tribes, so we'll just say any tribe that's in North Dakota or South Dakota, for instance, or Montana, they just don't get that opportunity that we have there. It's impossible for them. We could get 3 harvests a year in Navajo Nation land where they can only get 1 up there because of just winter coming so much sooner. So that creates a opportunity there for economic development with doing intertribal deals, where they know they don't live in the space that they could grow this, but they definitely, I'm sure, have other things that, you know, are useful in the forms of, we have free trade zones between tribal nations. So we could trade hempcrete for, you know, whatever another place would be utilizing in their area. You know, the tribes of the Pacific Northwest obviously have a much better opportunity at getting fresh fish, I would assume, than the Navajo Nation. And it creates up economic development between tribes that we would be able to do then as well, in that form of, you know, training the youth just to become, to learn the construction side of things, for instance, that then, you know, maybe they want to own their own construction company in a few years. And this could create forms of learning and teachings for everybody. I mean, it's a huge opportunity to create jobs where jobs don't exist, and then use everything in a good way that's going to help the people and not take away from anything for the people. And that, again, where, you know, the predecessor to the man that did this on Shiprock, unfortunately, you know, was chasing the greenbacks, as we say, was chasing the almighty dollar. for the betterment of himself and compared to the betterment of all the people.
Hmm. So at the bare minimum, what do you think for a hempcrete facility would cost?
Oh, geez. I mean, again, that would depend on scale. So, I mean, we could base it on basic construction prices, I guess. I mean, I would say $1 million could build you a small one. I don't know the price, you know. I've never built on the Navajo Nation, so I don't know how much that's going to range. Up to five.
Okay, so
you could,
having said that, you go in there and you take $1 million and say, okay, that money has to come from somewhere. The seed money. Living on the Navajo Nation, whether it's in Shiprock, Pinon, Chinle, Sanasi, how would somebody get that type of money to build a, you know, a facility?
Well, you know, there's different ways to go about that, of course. If we're trying to keep it inside of Navajo, that's going to be harder, of course. But as you mentioned, the Navajo Economic Development Department does have these micro lending departments. They have different loans. This would be, structure is always important when you're talking about building business, because essentially what we would be talking about here is doing, this would be a real estate deal, a real estate development deal that you would actually do, because you would build a building. You could call it a facility, it doesn't matter what it is. Essentially, you're building four walls and a roof with a concrete floor is what you're doing. So that's a real estate acquisition for a company. So let's just say that somebody like myself who doesn't live there, because I can't speak how I would do something if I was there, because I don't. But my thought process is, obviously, going through the business world, then it's about how I structure the deal. So I would have to have then a real estate company, in which case I would probably have to partner with somebody who is in that business that's probably an investor to loan us the $1 million or invest it into the company per se. And then, you know, in a dream world, you would set up accounts for your own businesses. You would then start a development company that then would agree that, you know, you would have to start a couple of companies in order to get the process going, because you would need a hemp company, but the hemp company is also not going to be the real estate company. Those are different entities. So, for instance, the Navajo Nation may be interested in loaning money to a Navajo-owned real estate company or a development company, but they won't want to loan it to a hemp company per se. So that's where things get funny in the business world as far as how deals are structured, of course, because the money, like you said in the beginning of your show, the money is there, and it is there for Navajo businesses.
Amen to that.
How do we get it, and how do we get the, I think you called them the key holders or the, you know, the powers that be.
Gatekeepers.
Yeah, the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers, the people that are in charge of the Economic Development Department, you know. How do we get that over to them? And that's just sheer, it's going to come back to sheer education. I mean, that's the main way that I see this, is that we have to educate and inform the people, because they didn't make this plant illegal because they did their own due diligence. That's not why. It's because one individual made a mockery of them and essentially laughed at them in their face. That's why they made it illegal. And then, of course, all the bad stuff that came with it, whether it's outsiders, violence that came to the, you know, there's a lot of bad things that came with not having a sound, moral, and ethically person in charge of what's running. So that's part of the due diligence part. You know, I myself, in 2016, I won a presidential award for lifetime achievement for volunteer service from President Barack Obama.
Nice.
For the amount of work that I've done in my life. So not to brag or tout my own, you know, thing, but that people don't get those awards doing bad things. And my predecessor surely wasn't walking that path. When your goal is to give back, and that's your main goal, which is my goal, which then implements into any company that I sit with, you know, again, I come from just morals and ethics is the first thing, so we have to do that. And then spreading that education to the people of the community, and the community being the entire Navajo Nation, I guess it's going to really start at the top, but at the bottom at the same, because the youth already understand. I've talked to many, I've talked to many different age groups from people at home, my cousins that are local there in their 70s, they feel how they feel about it, you know. And then I have cousins that are also in their late 20s, so they feel totally different. And they're actually in construction and would like to be in the construction side of this. And again, when we're spending $700 to $800 million from money, you know, that essentially all of that money is the people's money. There's some interesting things that are going on, of course, with the CARES Act and the ARPA Act. And I heard you mention at the beginning talking about that donation fund that was set up that I think has like $6.1 million still sitting in it. I think realized was something, right, $6 million. Well, I think what happened with that is they found out they were about to get caught because they did use and they did say in that fundraising through GoFundMe, which is documented, they used the Navajo Nation people.
Yep.
They didn't say the government. And that's where they were about to go wrong. And I think what happened was why that money didn't get spent is because they know if they spent the money, then they did something illegal. If they don't spend it, then they didn't do anything illegal yet. But once they spend it, they did. And they know that they used the Navajo Nation people. And that's the main difference here is that the people are the ones that actually get the money from the government. The United States government doesn't give just some LLC, BIA, you know, created entity. Like, they're not – the Navajo Nation government is not the Navajo Nation people. They are not the people. They are an entity that sits there because they're structured the way that America structured their system. It's not – and we could get into them talking about sovereignty and is the Navajo Nation sovereign, which of course they are not, because Russia is sovereign, China is sovereign, Japan is sovereign. Those are sovereign nations. The Navajo Nation is quasi-sovereign, if anything at best.
Limited sovereign.
Yeah, limited sovereignty, sure. We can use different adjectives. I forgot how the Constitution actually worded it. But we're not sovereign. It's a good way to talk about it. But the individual Navajo tribal member, they are sovereign. And they do have indigenous rights through the United Nations claiming that they're sovereign. We are the power, and we are actually the creditor that gives the Navajo Nation, because the Navajo Nation has over 300,000 members, that's why we get so much money from the United States government. It's the human bodies, i.e. the census numbers, right? My identification number that they are able to use as collateral at any point, right? That's how these systems, their banking system was created. They use the individual as collateral to borrow money. Just how the United States uses the human that has a Social Security number, they use us to borrow money from China. Because they're like, yes, we have a Social Security number here that proves that they'll pay taxes every year, and they're going to pay taxes for the next 73 years, and this is a total of that much money. And we have 330 million of them. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the Navajo Nation does the same thing. And now 400,000, I believe, we're up to because of the newest census. So we're now – the nation is going to raise more money that they do not distribute to the people. So –
theoretically speaking, it's supposed to be distributed,
sure,
but not.
Hey,
Mike. Let's get into that. I want to talk about economic development. You know, one of the things you're bringing up is the, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. I've owned a business since 1984, and it's been running, doing its own thing, It's not only to my customer agents, the Navajo Nation, it's all over the country. If not, going into other countries now. And, you know, it's not gotten me rich, but it's keeping me alive. And I've reached out many, many times to the Navajo Nation and asked and said, hey, can I tap into that, tap into this? I don't know how many presidents I've been gone through. I don't know how many council delegates I've talked to, how many speakers of the council I've talked to. You see some of my work all over the Navajo Nation. And so as far as legitimacy and the business know-how that I can give to the Navajo Nation, been there, said it. But the thing is this, is that, you know, the thing that I've run into, which I've talked about this gatekeeper scenario, is that we have a government, and I think that I hope that very soon that our people can come out of this mentality that we must rely on the government, whether it's the Navajo Nation government or whether it's the federal government. We need to be self-sufficient, self-sustaining, self-reliant. And how that we do that is that we can have people who are in office, president all the way down to the council delegate, and even the chapter people. Every tribal employee who has anything to do with authorizing business site lease, home site lease, you know, what have you, those are people who need to be so proactive, so knowledgeable, and just 100% supportive of the Navajo people. I'll tell you that. I mean, it's not a criticism on my own people or our people. It's a reality. There are gatekeepers there that are just not willing. They make the process harder. If you were coming in to tell the people how to change that mindset, you've been from the, you've lived off the res, you say your mother's from Farmington area, and what would you do? How would you convince and tell the people of the Navajo Nation that they should give out loans to its people so that they can grow and move forward?
Oof. So how would I convince, I guess, the economic development people, huh? And how to, that's a tough question that.
We've got 7 minutes, by the way. So
okay.
We need to wrap this up.
Sure. How would we talk to them about how to, I mean, I believe that it's showing and proving that creating jobs within the community, closest to your community, is what helps the community thrive and grow the most. And once you do that inside of a small community, then you can allow it to spread and go from there. And I think that it's just going to come down to a lot of conversation and proposals of new ways that they haven't seen yet. And, you know, elections is what it's also going to come down to, basically.
All right. Just a couple minutes because I need to put my clothing together. What do you got to say for your in closing? What would you like to say to the Navajo Native people, Navajo people out there?
Oh, to my fellow Diné, I'd like to say that we are the strongest and most resourceful people that are out here, and that once we come together as a community, we will be unstoppable. And we have opportunity to start economic development, and we have opportunity to start teaching and showing new ways of doing things, and that will spread and help all the way down to our youth, which will be able to then help our elders. I believe that food sovereignty is so extremely important, and that will help to train the youth for the future to set them up for success as I say, instead of setting people up for failure, and that I'm here to help, essentially. That's what I'm here on Mother Earth for, is to help my fellow man, my fellow Navajo, my fellow Native, my fellow brother, my fellow Earthling. And we have a lot to heal from a lot of generations. And we are at a time right now where that is coming about, and people are becoming a lot more conscious of some of the things and the hurt that we still carry around, and that together, collectively, that we'll be able to do that as a nation. And I believe that, you know, by creating jobs that are created essentially in the community, that's going to spread and help to create a community where we break bread with one another again and help each other with all of our individual projects, which then become collective projects.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for being a guest tonight, Mike. I can't remember what your name was. I knew you as Mike Diesel.
Mike Diesel, a.k.a. Dustin Oliver. But, yes, I am. Thank you for your time, Cal. Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks for doing this.
You betcha. Thank you. Yeah. Right, there you have it. This is I'm going to go ahead and end the show here. But in closing, here's some of the things that we ought to be thinking about. The Navajo Nation, we have economic development. We need to be pounding the pavement. We need to do everything possible to make it so that whatever idea, no matter how big or how small it might be, we should continue to support our people. Because there's an opportunity here. I mean, unfortunately, this COVID has given us some fortune, which is money, and to the tunes of millions of dollars. And now we're in the second phase of that. There's ARPA money that's sitting out there. We've got money that are that now with a $6.6 million. There's money to be given. Why not think about the Navajo business people? Let's not think about these monies in short terms that we can just give and then we go to the border town and blow it on border town and know there's nothing to show for it. Why not invest into our people who are willing to work and get put up businesses? It might be hemp. Well, if that hemp deal, we hope it gets resolved. If it does get resolved, if not, there's other businesses. Why not make this thing work? I brought this gentleman on for him to demonstrate what it is that he has in what he has in mind, what are some of the potential. That if we continue to talk as Navajo people, we have the know-how. We know how we've been given that innate ability to survive. We've survived here on this land long before the white man or any government has ever come to give us handout. We've lived. We can get back to that. That is self-sufficiency, self-reliance. We can do it, our people. That's what we mean by economic development. Development. Let's develop our economy. The economy is the people. I don't care what you say out there and how you think about economy. It's the people. Without the people, you cannot have business or people, workers or owners out there that can make this any economy go. The Navajo Nation, we need to be there. I'm so impressed with Council Delegate from Shiprock, Eugenia Charles Newton, who is supportive of the Navajo business owners. And bless her heart, she's trying to do the best that she knows how, and that we need more people like that. But we also need to elect people all the way from the president's office to the council delegates who have some sort of a business experience, business education, something in business. How can they talk about business when you don't understand what business is even about? So those are things we need to think about. This week's guest, I thank him for coming on board and sharing with some of the other. You can see how some difficulties are in the way. And it's not only that industry, it's all the way across the board. So shared on nanti the you know the growth or a shared on TV needle and they see the Calmez Ecuador a shared on Arasim ni kayada ho tato on hit the hozon nada kido on this a shared on
Hey!